Welcome to the Veritas Podcast. For even more exciting content, visit our website at www.veritaswbc.com. Enjoy the podcast.
We're continuing this series on disturbing divine behavior, and tonight we're going to look into the story in Genesis 22 on the binding of Isaac, which has given a lot of people a reason for pause. It's a narrative that people have struggled with for a number of reasons. I'll just go ahead and say up front, you know, if you've read Genesis 22, let me just see by a show of hands, how many of you have read Genesis 22 when God commands Abraham to sacrifice Isaac? That's most of the crowd. So here's the thing. You obviously know that Isaac doesn't die. And so we'll just go ahead and throw that out there right off the bat and get started with that. But it does bring up some other questions, like if God doesn't even intend for Isaac to die, then why in the world command Abraham to do something like that? Or when I was in North Carolina, I remember an exchange I had with a skeptic. Actually, I think he was an atheist, but he described himself as a skeptic. And he brings up this narrative and he says, I mean, you know, what's the deal? If you don't want Isaac to die, then why command it? Is God just screwing with people? Well, the sentiment that he had is fairly representative of the way that a lot of people look at the text. It's just one of those that people struggle with. So I wanted to do some things in terms of unpacking what's happening in Genesis 22, fill you in on some information, but also give you the chance to ask some questions. So if you go to menti.com, remember, you got to put in the code 817304, and then we're all going to be on the same page. And in a little bit, Matthew's going to join me up here, and we'll take your questions. Hopefully, the answers will be helpful. But a couple of things to remember in advance. So the Bible has a heartbreaking tale of child sacrifice practiced in the name of Molech. Now, we talked about that last week. There's only so much that I want to say about it this week. But that was a god of the Ammonites, and Molech worship was practiced by the Ammonites and the Canaanites, who revered Molech as a protecting father figure. You have images of Molech were made of bronze, and their outstretched arms were heated red hot. Living children were then placed into the idol's hands, and they died there, or they were rolled into a fire pit below the idol. Some sources indicate that a child might also be, and I just quote, passed through the fire, literally, prior to the actual sacrifice in order to purify or to baptize the child. Now, Molech worship, just so you know, occurred in the Hinnom Valley, which is near Jerusalem. And because of this, the valley became associated with the idea of Tophat, or what we might also refer to as hell. And you can find this in Isaiah chapter 30. You can find this in Jeremiah chapter 19. You can find this also in Mark chapter 9, just as a couple of examples. Later, the evil king Manasseh offered his own son as a sacrifice in 2 Kings chapter 21. Ahaz offered his own son as a sacrifice in 2 Chronicles chapter 28. The people of Judah, just so you know, participated in this crime against their own sons, a sin so detestable that God said that it would have never crossed his mind for them to have done this in Jeremiah chapter 32. Child sacrifice, just so you know, was one of the reasons for the Babylonian captivity. So I just wanted to begin that place. You have this contrast of the worship of Molech with the atrocities where children are literally singed or burned in the arms of the idol or underneath the idol. But you also see this contrast in the way that God is viewing things. There's also this in Deuteronomy chapter 12, verses 29 to 32. It says, "The Lord your God will cut off before you the nations you are about to invade and dispossess. But when you have driven them out and settled in their land, and after they have been destroyed before you, be careful not to be ensnared by inquiring about their gods, saying, 'How do these gods serve? How do these nations serve their gods?' Well, we will do the same. You must not worship the Lord your God in their way, because in worshiping their gods, they do all kinds of detestable things that God hates. They even burn their sons and daughters in the fire as sacrifices to their gods. See that you do all I command you. Do not add to it. Do not take away from it." Now, I could give you more. I just wanted to give you a taste that what you find, at least in Scripture, is that God isn't desiring human or child sacrifice. That's just against anything that God desires. And yet, you have this shocking command. in Genesis chapter 22. Let me give you a little bit of background. At the age of 75, Abraham was given an incredible promise from God. Abraham and his wife Sarah would be given something that they had desperately wanted for a lot of years, and that was going to be a son. And through the birth of this son, God would bless Abraham in a number of ways. And not just Abraham, but he says, I'm going to bless the nations. God would make Abraham a great nation, Genesis 12, 2. In Abraham, all of the families of the earth would be blessed, Genesis chapter 12, verse 3. And his descendants would be as numerous as the dust of the earth. That's Genesis chapter 13, verse 16. Now, a number of years pass without a son being born to Abraham and Sarah. I'm sure that you probably remember that. And when God repeated his promise of a son, by the way, in Genesis 17, he repeats a promise and they laugh at God. Such a thing, by the way, at this point is improbable. At least that's the way that they were looking at it. And I probably would see it the same way. But in spite of their doubts, Abraham and Sarah's miracle child was finally born. This is in Genesis chapter 21. Verse 5, if you want to be specific. And he was named Isaac, which means he laughs. And their laughter of skepticism had turned into a laughter of joy. God had made a promise. God delivers on his promise. Sometime later, this shocking command comes from God to Abraham. Take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. Genesis chapter 22, verse 2. And you're like, well, that maybe was, how long of a gap was there between the birth in 21 and what's happening in 22? I'm going to unpack that here in a little bit, so hold on. But did those words really come from God, who on the one hand seems to be saying, hey, I don't want child sacrifice, but then it's like Genesis 22 seems to be saying it. How could God ask a father to kill his own son? And skeptics who are seeking to discredit the Bible, I've quoted Richard Dawkins before, he describes the binding of Isaac as, quote, a disgraceful story of child abuse and bullying. Okay. However, one of the things that I want to point out is that the command of Genesis 22, it really was not immoral. Rather, the binding of Isaac, which is what this is famously known as, should be seen as a test of Abraham's devotion to God. It should be a rejection of child sacrifice, but it also should be a foreshadowing of what we see ultimately in Jesus. So let's go on to the test part. Does that sound good? There's going to be three parts, and I just want you to remember those three parts. Let's go to the test of Abraham's devotion. So Genesis 22 begins by informing us that the command of verse 2 was a test. It even tells you that right off the bat. Clearly, it was not God's desire for Isaac to die. However, Abraham was given no hint, if you look at the text, he was given no hint that he was merely being tested. That's not what comes out. I'm just doing a little test here. What if I said, go sacrifice your son? That's actually not there. And so the reader of Genesis 22, we don't need to think that the nature of the command made Abraham's obedience less difficult. We don't need to put the text that way. God wasn't giving any consolation, at least like that. The command to sacrifice Isaac was similar to the earlier command that God gave to Abraham in Genesis 12:1. Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. My friend Paul Copan, he wrote this. Abraham had left his home in Ur and given up his past for the sake of God's promise. Now he was being asked if he would trust God by apparently surrendering his future as well. I've given up my past. Now you're asking me to give up my future. And everything Abraham ever hoped for was tied up into the son of promise. Victor Hamilton, he said this about the story. He points out that the command take is followed by a participle, which is normally translated something like this. Please take your son. The way that the command even reads is not like when you're just fed up with your kid because they haven't cleaned their room and the time that you said for them to. It's that God knows that he's asking Abraham to do something that's incredibly difficult. He issues the command, but he does it like this. I want you to please take your son, and I want you to take him up on the mountain. God knows that what he's asking Abraham to do is incredibly difficult. Hamilton also points out that that participle is used only 5 times in the entire Old Testament when God speaks to a person. And every time God asks the individual to do something that's pretty staggering, something that defies like a rational explanation or understanding, which I'm guessing you and I would probably feel that way if God were telling us that, it indicates that God was sensitive to how difficult the command was going to be. every single time. Verse 3 in chapter 22 says this: Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, took two of his young men with him, and his son Isaac. Now there's a scholar named James Crenshaw, and he said this: the astonishing thing about this command is that Abraham's readiness to accept such a word without the slightest whisper of an objection. Now I want you to think about this, because Bart Ehrman, who is a skeptic, actually I think he's an atheist now, professor at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, says it's precisely Abraham's obedience that was his failure. Isn't that interesting? Because the way that Ehrman is looking at it is that, you know, no loving father should have ever followed a command as abhorrent as this one. No hint from Abraham that he hesitated in obedience. But if you think about Abraham and you look at the rest of the narrative, he had been bold enough to question God in the past. Before this even happens, God says some things, and Abraham's like, well, I don't know. In Genesis 18, when God told Abraham that he would destroy the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, Abraham argued that this judgment was unfair. This is before God has asked him to sacrifice his son. In fact, he says in Genesis 18, shall not the judge of all the earth do what is just? I mean, on the one hand, you've got him saying, hey, go sacrifice your son. And Abraham's like, all right. But just a few chapters earlier, it says, we're going to judge Sodom and Gomorrah. And he goes, oh, hold on. I mean, a holy God wouldn't do something this unjust. So what's the difference here? I mean, why didn't Abraham question the fairness of the command to sacrifice Isaac? And bottom line, we're not told why. There's nothing in Genesis 22 that says, and this is why he had no problem with it, at least not explicitly. But perhaps Abraham had learned to trust that the judge of all the earth does in fact do what is always right, somewhere between Genesis 18 and this moment. So what was the purpose of God's test of Abraham? So when Abraham, quote, reached out his hand and he took the knife to slaughter his son in verse 10, the angel of the Lord speaking on behalf of God says to Abraham, don't lay your hand on the boy, don't do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, and seeing you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. So the purpose of the test was to demonstrate whether or not Abraham feared God, an actual tangible demonstration of his fear and trust in God. And Abraham's willingness to sacrifice his son, by the way, practically and tangibly showed that he did. But what does it mean to fear God? That's a good question. I mean, one helpful definition of the fear of God is affectionate reverence. So to fear God means to love and to obey him. And there's a connection between the love of God and obedience to God. It's not just an affection. It's like in your feet. It's what you do. To love God is to obey him. Tim Keller, by the way, when he was studying this narrative on Abraham and Isaac, he believes that God's test of Abraham was about loving God supremely. Supremely. Above anything in the here and now, supreme love. Abraham, by the way, might have been in danger of slipping into idolatry. This child is going to be a source of blessing. And so this child becomes something that Abraham worships. What Tim Keller defines idolatry, when you think about it, as the making of good things into ultimate things. And maybe there was this concern that his son, so blessed of God, this intention to be a blessing to the nations, maybe this was something that Abraham was being tested with. We are to put nothing, including a very good thing like a son, before God. Absolutely nothing. So the first commandment says, you shall have no other gods before me, in Exodus chapter 20, verse 3. Actually, it says, you will have no other gods above me, beneath me, in front of me, or behind me. That's actually what the Hebrew means. It's like nothing in the vicinity of the way that you love and revere me. And that would also include, that would include a son. Abraham had desperately, when you think about it, wanted a son. Now that he has the son, who was he going to love more, Isaac or God? And in the end, Abraham's obedience to such a command proved that he was most devoted to God. And again, let me point out, tangibly and in front of others. The other reason that makes this important is because of the background that I started this conversation with. When you see Molech and you see this idol where the arms are heated up like a fire and they lay a living child into the arms, you see a huge contrast in Genesis 22 versus the worship of Molech, don't you? One of the things that you see tangibly and in front of you in this story in Genesis 22 is that that's exactly what God does not want. So that doesn't happen in the abstract. And what Abraham was able to do through his obedience was to demonstrate from all the surrounding cultures that are either putting their children on fire red arms of a statue, of an idol, or literally passing their living child through the flames underneath the statue, is that God doesn't want this. So, nevertheless, though, it was a test. I'm going to throw this out there to you. I think about Jesus, and when you think of the passion of Jesus, I'm still sold that even though he knew that there was suffering in front of him, even though that he knew that there was glory beyond it, he still suffers. He still suffers. He still hurts. He still feels isolation and separation. You know, knowing what is coming about is one thing. It doesn't necessarily mean that the pain is going to be any less real. And what you see in this story of Abraham and Isaac is, as I'm going to point out here in a second, a foreshadowing of that story that God is going to provide. Second thing, the binding of Isaac is actually a rejection of child sacrifice. Now, before addressing the issue of child sacrifice, there are a couple of details that don't need to be overlooked. It is possible that Isaac was willing to die. Scholars have pointed this out. Isaac is often mentioned as a little boy who was forced to submit to his father. I think that's, in fact, the way that Richard Dawkins is looking at it. However, Isaac was probably, maybe you could even say, the stronger of the two when you look at Abraham and Isaac. Abraham was old at this point, right? I mean, the promise begins when he's 75. He's aged, even from there. Now, no doubt he went to Gold's Gym and he lifted weights and stuff, but Isaac was probably the stronger of the two. Abraham was an elderly man, over 100 years old. The text suggests that Isaac was at least a teenager, maybe even a young adult at this point. So we have this image of child sacrifice where what you have is maybe this infant child that's being carted up onto a mountain, and that's probably not what's happening. At least the consensus of scholars would disagree with that. In both verses 5 and 12, Isaac is called a boy. But most translations note that another possible translation of the Hebrew word na'ar is young man. So he's a young man. One Old Testament scholar, last name is Hartley, points out that na'ar is also used in Genesis 22 for Abraham's younger men, his servants. It's the exact same word in verses 3 and 5 and 19. And so it's possible that Isaac was around the same age as the servants when they're walking up the mountain where the sacrifice was to happen. Furthermore, verse 6 says that Isaac carries the wood up for the offering, if you look at the text. And this would probably be a task that's just a little much if you're talking about a literal infant boy, right? And if Isaac had been a young man, it's improbable that, you know, somebody as old as Abraham would be able to force him up on the altar when you think about it. In verse 9, we're told that Abraham bound Isaac. There's an Old Testament scholar that I really respect named Gordon Wenham, taught a friend of mine. He said this: "That an elderly man was able to bind the hands and feet of a lively teenager strongly suggests Isaac's consent." Strongly suggests it. Here's the second thing. The text hints that Abraham thought Isaac would be delivered. He had the expectation that this was what was going to happen, or at least raised from death. And we see that in verse 5. Abraham says to his servants, "Stay here with the donkey. I and the boy will go over there and worship, and we will come again to you." So why did he say that? "I and the boy will come again to you," especially if he knows what he's going up there to do, right? "I'm going to go and I'm going to sacrifice the boy. No, we're both coming back." That would be a weird thing to think. Perhaps he was trying to conceal the truth. Some scholars have suggested that. He's trying to hide what he's doing from the servants. I'm not sold on that. I think a better explanation that these words were an expression of Abraham's faith. I think that's the better rendering of it. And why? Because he believed the promise of God had been given to him already. Promises that depend on that boy staying alive. So at the end of the day, what this means is that Abraham's full expectation is even if I put the dagger into the chest, God's going to raise this boy back up. Because God is not going to pull back on his word. So by faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offers up Isaac. And he who had received the promises was in the act of offering his only son, of whom it was said, "Through Isaac shall your offspring be named." And so he considered that God was able even to raise him from the dead, which figuratively speaking, in a way, he kind of did, right? He kept that boy from dying. In Exodus 22:29, God does say this, "The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me." However, I want to be clear, this does not mean that God wanted the Israelites to literally sacrifice their firstborn son. That has nothing to do with it. The point was that everything rightly belongs to God. And by it would also mean more than your firstborn son. It would mean everything. So the point was everything rightfully belongs to God. The Israelites were able to redeem their firstborn son. And so that's the second point. Here's the third and the last for tonight. This is a foreshadowing of God's own sacrifice. This narrative is a foreshadowing of God's own sacrifice. Now I want to be clear here. For what some do is they look at Isaac, and what they see in Isaac is the offering, just like later Jesus is going to be the offering. But we need to be careful with that because Isaac doesn't die. Jesus does. And so if you want to see a huge contrast in the story of Isaac and Jesus, you just go to who died and who didn't. Instead, what you see in the story is that God is going to provide a sacrifice. And you see that in Genesis 22 for sure. So while we focused on Abraham's obedience, perhaps the most important message of the story is God's provision. Thankful for Abraham's obedience, I'm more thankful for God's provision. When I was mentioning the Old Testament scholar Hamilton, he said this, appropriately, Abraham names this place Yahweh Yireh, meaning Yahweh sees or Yahweh provides. He does not call this site Abraham obeyed. It's God provides. The verb provide, by the way, which you see in verse 8 of chapter 22, God will provide for himself the lamb, literally means to see. There's an Old Testament scholar, last name is Walton, very influential Old Testament scholar, said this usage approximates one of the uses of the verb to see that we also have in English. So when we say, I will see to it that the report is done on time, we're using the verb to see to convey that the details are going to be taken care of. It's the same thing here. So God saw to it that there would be a lamb for the burnt offering. So in the binding of Isaac, it's not difficult to see Abraham as a type of the father. You can see somewhat of Isaac as a type of the son, minus the death, because he doesn't actually die. The actions of Abraham foreshadow the father's giving up of his son, or the handing over of his son. And then when you think about it, in the rest of the narrative in Genesis 22, when it says God will provide, he in fact does. It's not Isaac that dies, it's the animal over in the thicket that is ultimately sacrificed. God sees and God provides. The nearest New Testament allusion to the binding of Isaac is probably in Romans 8:32, as far as I can tell, where Paul writes that God did not spare his own son, but he gave him up for us all. And during the baptism of Jesus, the voice from heaven says, "You are my son." And when you think about this, the words are reminiscent of how God describes Isaac, your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love. You do see those connections for sure. But again, for Jesus, there was no one to take his place on the cross, unlike a ram in a thicket. Jesus was provided. Jesus was the provided Lamb of God, who was, as Isaiah 53:7 says, led to the slaughter to die for the sins of the world. And so as Abraham and Isaac did the work of servants, thankful for them, by the way, Abraham chopping the wood for the burnt offering, Isaac carrying the wood, as the story goes, so the Father, Heavenly Father, and the Son served me and you, served a broken world. Jesus proclaimed that, and I quote, "The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." And one of the things that I see that's similar in terms of a connection between Isaac and Jesus is this. It would be one thing, as some scholars have pointed out, you know, we're not talking about the sacrifice of an infant. We're talking about the equivalent of a person seeing that there's a grenade on the ground and somebody jumping on it to save others. You know, usually when we have a story like that, we don't say that it's morally atrocious. When we have a story of sacrifice like that, we consider these people to be heroes. We consider these people to be exemplars. We're thankful for their selflessness in a world that's filled with selfishness. So when you look at the command of God, do I think, like my skeptic friend in North Carolina says, God just screwing with them by giving the command? That's a quote. And as I said to him, I don't think that's what's happening here. Instead, I think through the command, one, we're seeing what real obedience looks like. I think there's that. But number two, we're actually seeing what it is that God really wants and how God provides that can only be seen through the command. So is Genesis 22 a difficult passage? Yeah. Is it a command that says, and so for every parent everywhere, you need to take your firstborn son and you need to take them out into the woods, up on a hill perhaps, and you need to sacrifice them? And the answer is no, because what you have is a command of God that was given to a man in a specific place at a specific time for a specific purpose, which is completely different than saying, I am giving a command for all people everywhere at all times to do this. Remember what the command was for, and remember what was demonstrated through it. That's a good place to stop. So what I want to do is I want to invite Matthew up. We certainly have some things to talk about, and as he comes up, I'll give you a look ahead to next week. One of the passages that has given me maybe the biggest struggle as I read the Bible is found in Judges. The book of Judges is probably the most graphically violent book in all of the Bible. And aside from the death of Jesus, which I think is arguably the most horrific thing to happen, in Judges, you find a Canaanite, what you find is a concubine that's delivered over. And at least as the story reads, she is raped through the whole night. And what you see as the story unfolds is her master, so to speak, opens the door in the morning and she's laying at the foot of the door, dead. And that's only a part of the story because it gets worse from there. As we look into this series on disturbing divine behavior, I thought it was only fitting that I go to one of the stories that has bothered me the most and to see if I can make some sense out of it for you. That's just what's coming next week. But for now, you ready to turn to some questions? Do we have any?
Oh, we have a few.
Okay.
Yep.
Great.
Yep, we're good.
Well, let's turn to those.
Some really good ones. You know, we'll be talking about divine foreknowledge and partial divine foreknowledge. That's going to be really good, I think, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Sure.
Yeah. I like it.
Yeah.
You do an entire...
Is that a question you're going to ask, or did somebody out here
ask it?
No, I think it's
a question that's being asked here.
Okay. Fair enough.
If God knows all, why would he say, now I know you fear God?
Right. Yeah. So... don't lie to me. Did you ask that question?
I did not ask that
question. All right, okay. So why would the text say something like, oh, now I know, right? More than one person has asked this question. Now, just to give you I'll give you somebody I disagree with first. How about that? Just to be fair. But somebody that I respect. There's a guy named Greg Boyd. And Greg Boyd is what is called an open theist. And I don't know how many of you know what open theism is. But here's basically the idea behind open theism, is that there are some things about the future that God does not know, that God is omniscient with regard to everything that it is possible for God to know. But there are some things about the future that God has not settled from within himself, and as a result, there are some things that God does not know. Now, there's a lot to discuss there in terms of the way that they view time and all that. I'm not doing that right now, right? But Greg Boyd would say this, the text tells you, what does it say? Mm-hmm. It says basically this, that God actually figured something out, that God did not know, and that through the command and the obedience of Abraham, God actually figured out. You can get this represented, if you want the kind of a big picture of Greg Boyd's line of thought, you can read his book, God of the Possible. Are there some things about the future that God knows? And the answer is, you bet. A lot of things that God had settled from eternity past, but there were a number of things that he left up to free creatures, and even though it's a range of possibilities of what could happen, God wasn't absolutely 100% certain, and this verse would be one example. I'm not there.
A question, though, on that. So when he says, now I know, right, there's two different types of know, of knowledge.
Absolutely.
Right? So we could look at this as, now he knows as in a point of fact.
Absolutely.
Or now we know because it's a relationship that's been developed or a relationship that's been proven.
You bet.
About where they are in there.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's nothing problematic to me. Mm-hmm. All right, so let me give an example with my girls.
Right.
All right. I can actually pretty well look at the face of my girls and tell you what they're going to do, right? Now, I know it a lot of times before they do it. Most of the time, in fact, I do because I've gotten pretty good at reading my girls. And then they do it. Here's the thing. I knew it before they did it, and I knew it when they did it as well, right? There's nothing problematic with saying, now I know. That doesn't preclude from saying, and I also knew it before. I knew what this was going to look like. But there are different ways of talking about knowledge. Some of us, when it comes to the Christian faith, we need to be very clear. You know, it's one thing to say that I know Jesus. Well, the demons know Jesus, right? That's one thing. That's one type of knowledge. But there's also an experiential kind of knowledge, and it doesn't happen in the abstract. It happens in what's lived out. So on the one hand, it's before it happens, God knows it's going to happen. But as these things are coming about, you have something happening in the relationship between Abraham and God that had not happened before Abraham said, I'm going to obey. And that's talking about more of that relational knowledge that only Abraham could come to grips with as he obeys. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So, two different types of knowledge.
Mr. Boyd didn't read the actual Hebrew.
I think that there's a problem with the way he treated the text. But if you're just sitting there reading it, how many of you looked at Genesis 22? And he goes, and now I know. And it's about God, right? And you go, what does that mean? Did God not know before? All right, don't lie to me. How many of you have wondered that before when you read Genesis? Fair question. I think it's a great question. You see a difference here in the way that I would handle it and the way that Greg Boyd handles it. I just wanted to be fair.
Right.
Greg Boyd would sit in that chair and go, well, you're wrong.
Right.
Yeah. Right? He didn't know. God actually figured out something about Abraham.
Well, entire books have been written about.
Entire books have been written.
Very thing.
About absolutely. How, so yeah. It's a great question, though.
It is. We have another one. This seems to be very popular, so I guess I'll ask it.
Go for it.
Ready? Okay. Why would Abraham think this was a command from God when child sacrifice is contrary to God's character?
Yeah. So why would he think that this is a command from God? One is because when you think about it, the way that Genesis 22 reveals it is the command came from God to him, right? Abraham, at this point, you got to understand, go back, and this is why I was unpacking some of the narrative before. You think Abraham has figured out the voice of God yet? Imagine when he's sitting in the Ur, right? And God calls him up and he says, I want you to go to a place that I will show you. By the way, usually what we want is, so I want all the details.
Right.
And then we'll go. And instead, God says, I want you to go to a place that I'll show you. So Abraham wakes up the next morning and is like, all right, left or right, where am I going? Right? Mm-hmm. Do you think that God had figured out the voice of God in all of this? And I think the answer is you have to keep all of the narrative together. He had been communing and talking with God all the way up. And then in Genesis 22, what do you hear? Same voice of God says, okay, now I want you. And again, I love the Hebrew there because he knows the command is tough. But what does he say? I want you to take your son and I want you to take him up on the mountain, right? The reason he identifies it as the voice of God is because it's the same voice that he had been hearing the whole time. But that's why also unpack the rest of the story. His expectation is since God is commanding this, this boy's coming back down this hill with me one way or another. Even if I sacrifice him,
right,
he's going to come back alive.
Which is into, okay, I'm not going to go there.
No,
okay.
No, feel free.
No, yeah. No, we're good.
Oh, right, okay. All right.
Okay. Hey,
how many of you want to know what Matthew was thinking? Can I hear from you?
Not on that one.
All right, we have hands that are going up. I don't know.
I don't see anyone.
It's all right.
So some of them are dealing with symbolism, really. So in verse 4, there's 3 days. There are 3 days on the journey. And usually that kind of leads to an ominous thing in the Old Testament.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's references in Genesis 34, Genesis 40, Joseph and his brothers. Is that pointing towards? Yeah, I think you know where I'm going with this. With the look on your face, does this point at all towards
Jesus?
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you think,
some would
work?
Make a connection between the 3 days that are mentioned. Mm-hmm. You're right, because you have this. You know, as Jonah was in the belly of the whale for 3 days, you have the other things that you mentioned. The threeness kind of comes up throughout Scripture. Again, there's no problem with saying what you have here is something that actually happened, but you also get connections to a future type, which was my third point, right? So where do you have Jesus? We have Jesus' death, and then where is Jesus for 3 days? There's this season that's somewhat ominous. Even the disciples have scattered. They don't look so good, right? They think that it's over. Peter has gone back to fishing. Jesus has to appear to Peter multiple times before he's restored back to ministry and so forth. Yeah, I don't have any problem with saying there's also symbolism here. That what's happening in Genesis 22 is also symbolic of something that's going to happen later with the disciples and what unfolds in the passion of Jesus. There's no problem with that at all.
Yeah.
A lot of connections get made
in
Genesis 22 and Jesus. There's a lot of symbolism. Yeah, rightly so.
Yeah. I mean, even the wood itself that he cuts before he takes up.
Yep.
I mean, we could go on forever related to that, but we don't want to bore these people.
No, we don't.
No, okay.
That's right.
Okay, this is almost not, it's not a repeat, but it's kind of more of a clarification related to Abraham's heart. If God is omnipotent and knows everything, why would he test Abraham in this way, even when he already knows Abraham's heart?
So why would God test Abraham when he already knows Abraham's heart?
Is
because it's more than God trying to figure something out. It's God demonstrating something through Abraham's obedience. One, there was something for Abraham to figure out. I mean, remember, this is why I pointed out in Genesis 18, when God says, okay, now I'm going to render judgment onto Sodom and Gomorrah. And what was Abraham's response? Whoa, I thought you were a just God, right? So he pushes back on what God is going to do. That's why I said, it seems by the time you get to Genesis 22, whenever that gap of time is, we're not sure. But by the time that you get to Genesis 22, you know, Abraham is demonstrably showing something about what he understands about the character and the goodness of God, which is very different from the Abraham that's pushing back on God in Genesis chapter 18. So it's more than, do I think God is figuring something out? No, I don't. I think something is being demonstrated through Abraham's obedience. Abraham comes to understand something through his obedience. And the other thing, and this is why I was pointing this out, you also see the contrast between Yahweh and those that are worshiping Molech and other gods that are literally passing their children through fire alive, right? And again, that's not something that happens in the abstract. That's something that happens through what is lived out. God is not desiring of this. So it's a teaching moment, not just for Abraham, but for everybody else that's around him.
Right.
So no, I don't think God is messing with people.
I
hope I was clear on that.
You know, today? I mean,
like my skeptic friend up in North Carolina. Right. Why are you commanding? If you've already figured all this out, it's because it's not about what God knows.
Right.
Right?
So you made a point earlier that most likely Isaac was older teen, younger adult, possibly.
Mm-hmm.
This is a question that probably would look at him more as, it could either be a post-traumatic stress issue or a child abuse issue. And I know sometimes people look at this without really knowing the age of Isaac, this could have been child abuse or looked at, especially in our lens today.
Right.
Any evidence that there was some sort of issue later on with Isaac? I mean, we don't really see a lot after that.
No. I mean, you know, again, Richard Dawkins says that this is an instance of child abuse and bullying. So, you know, for what you find in Richard Dawkins is also true in the concern that's being brought up here. But again, I think the contrast needs to be set pretty clearly. Isaac understands what's being asked of him in the text. Since the third point was he's a foreshadowing of a future sacrifice, at least in a sense. Jesus understands what's being asked of him. And that's why I ended the discussion the way that I did. You know, when you have a person that is willing to sacrifice themselves, you know, for the benefit of others, you know, now we would consider that to be a selfless act and a heroic act, right? I mean, Isaac knew what was being asked of him, and Isaac was participating in what was being asked of him. I mean, that's exactly how the text reads, mm-hmm. right? So I try to keep all that information together before I make a judgment on what's going on in the text.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So do I see this as an act of bullying? If so, then, you know, Isaac certainly didn't pick up on it.
No.
Right?
And it's very obvious there that he tells him that it's you.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, he tells him it's you. Isaac's over there saying, getting the wood and going, well, let's go up the hill, right? There's nothing that would indicate in Genesis 22 that Isaac is over there unwilling or an infant, right? Isaac full well knows what it is that he is doing. And that, I think, makes a significant difference in what is happening here. Now, again, connect that to the thing that I was saying before. God is trying to demonstrate something through the command to Abraham, through Isaac, that was not meant to be for all people at all times and all places. So when you have a person, that's why I say keep the whole narrative together. It's important. So if you have some mom that's like, well, I was reading Genesis 22, so I decided to kill all my kids. She needs to read Genesis 22 a little bit more closely. Right?
Yeah, we have a question that's similar to that.
Okay.
Is related to that idea of what keeps people from doing that. Now, based on seeing it happen in the Bible, but you're saying based on if you read the whole story.
Yeah, you read the whole story, and what do you get? In Genesis 22, it's not a sacrifice that I desire, right? It's a sacrifice that I'll provide. That's the key difference in Genesis 22. In every other instance, and that's why I was giving the quotes that I was before from Manasseh and others that are also participating in child sacrifice. If you go and read Kings as well as other texts, they're constantly held up as negative examples, right? So if they're being held up as a negative example, then what you don't do is say that this is something that God wants us to emulate. In fact, what you get is that that's exactly something God doesn't want us to emulate.
Right?
So that's what I'm saying. Read the whole story. Read the whole story. And even in those instances where a sacrifice is being offered up, and even in Judges when sacrifices are being offered up to God, you know, hey, my, you know, whatever walks out the front door of my house, you know, and God's up there going, what is the matter with you? I mean, what else walks through the front door of your house except probably your kid, right? It was a stupid thing to say. Right? It wasn't something that God desired. It was a knuckleheaded move on the part of a bad parenting moment. How about that? Can we just say that? All of the other examples that were given before, they're held up as a negative example. That's why I said, hey, this is not something that is prescriptive, something God is wanting for other people. It is something that is descriptive. It is something that happened in a time and in a place that what you find is God wasn't even endorsing. That to me is really important. So if you read in the newspaper, some mom or dad, you know, following in the footsteps of Abraham before, I'm like, go read it closer, because that's not what happened.
Right. So there's some questions there at the end of whenever the angel returns and says that the sacrifice in that regard does not have to happen. Some would argue that that it was Abraham's choice to say, you know, I'm going to go ahead and just sacrifice something. Or did he feel like, or was that a requirement? Did he do it on his own as a sacrifice to God? Or did he do it because he felt...
Are you talking about the ram in the thicket?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that was something done to God, right?
Well, that's what I'm saying. There's debate about it. I'm just curious your thought of...
If you look in Genesis 22, God will provide.
Right.
Right. So if Isaac isn't the sacrifice, then who's the sacrifice? And that's why I said you need to be careful with how strong of a line you draw between Isaac and Jesus. Mm-hmm. Isaac doesn't die. Jesus does, right? God will provide a sacrifice.
To clarify that, though, but the way Abraham did this, the way Abraham brought it up, you could say that at that point he had died to Abraham because he's allowing this to happen. Is that too far of a stretch for that? To if you're trying to do the Isaac-Jesus story or trying to compare the two, or is that...
No.
That's,
no. Okay. I don't think it's too far of a stretch.
Okay. So it's a legitimate comparison.
Yep. Well, again, you have a lot of comparisons in Genesis 22, right? Get some wood, get a cross. I mean, I think you were bringing that up that earlier, right? You have all of this the symbolism in Genesis 22, which is very rich and it's meaningful and it connects us to what Jesus ultimately did in his crucifixion. So. Right. Which again, you know, some would say, well, see, that's an act of child sacrifice. Well, again, no, Jesus wasn't a child. Jesus was an adult. And when we look at a sacrifice, again, some sacrifices we look at as heroic and worthy and selfless.
Right.
Those, I think, are the moral differences between what are usually brought up as concerns in these stories and what we're finding in Scripture.
Right. Okay. This is a question that's more of a clarification. And I, as you saw, the slides were not working. That was my fault. So I'll take full blame for that.
Okay.
Earlier on,
it's
grace wasn't up there. It was chaos. Anyways, I didn't hear this question. So I didn't hear you say this. So forgive me. But the difference between Tophat and Sheol, is that you brought that up earlier?
I was just making a point that the place, you know, if you go back to the place where some of these places were happening, is reckoned as a place of hell.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
That was it. Right.
Like
so
Diana.
It's a
play.
Yeah. So, yeah. Okay. So when you look at, so then you go to say, well, what is this supposed to represent in terms of hell? And you go, well, what is hell? This is a place of tremendous suffering and affliction and so forth. And so this connection to early child sacrifice practices are also connected to a place of suffering and affliction and oppression. That was the only point that I was trying to make there. Nothing more and nothing less.
Okay.
The Hinnom Valley, is where I was connecting.
That's where you're going with it. Okay.
Yeah. Which is not, when you think about it, not far from Jerusalem, right?
Oh, wow. This is kind of a funny question. I'm going to ask it anyway, just because it's...
He reads it and goes, oh, wow.
I don't know. Yeah. You know, it's whatever. It's one of these... I'd like to know who came up with this one. It just came across the moderation. It's probably going to fly up the chart here. But so how many nights did Abraham have to sleep on the couch after telling Sarah about almost killing their only son?
How many nights did he have to sleep on the couch?
Yeah.
Unrecorded. I don't know.
I've never seen it.
I'm going to follow one of my professors. Is where the Bible is silent. Go ye and do likewise. Yeah. I don't have any idea. I don't know.
Yeah.
By the way, what was the movie where it was in a popular film? You know, where he's taking it, you have the binding of Isaac, and you have this moment where he's taking him up on the mountain, right? And then mom's down the hill, mm-hmm. and she all of a sudden has this moment, and she's like, I think I know what's going on here. And she's like running up the hill. And I was like, I don't remember this in Genesis 22.
No.
But you got to be dramatic about it, right? And so, but by the time she gets up there, everything is good. She's like, oh, the boy is okay. I don't know. How many nights do you want to say he had to sleep outside of the
hut?
How about
three?
I think since three is the number, we're just going to stick with that.
That good ominous.
As Jonah was in the belly of the whale for three nights. That's right. So he slept outside for three nights.
So we just add that to the next commentary.
Yeah, that's little, right.
That's
exactly right.
Yeah, let's see here. Where are we? some of these are repeats. We're kind of, they're just clarifications here. Let's see here.
Yeah.
As Isaac worshipped at the sacrifice of the ram, wouldn't this demonstration of provision of God in keeping with the intent of the Abrahamic covenant serve to strengthen Isaac's understanding?
Yeah, that's a good question.
That is a good question.
Was it served to strengthen Isaac's understanding of the covenant?
Yeah, Isaac's pretty silent through most of this. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think in a sense you could see why the answer to that would be yes, mm-hmm. right? All along, and I want to be very clear about this, because some people look at the Old Testament and think that God in the Old Testament is kind of angry, right? And I think we need to get over that. And I'm not saying that there aren't moments where God gets angry, because there are clearly moments where God gets angry, as I was talking about the judgment of Sodom and Gomorrah before. But it's always tempered with a lot of mercy and grace and his provision. It's always that. And if you look at Romans chapter 4, we see something of Abraham, right? Because in Romans 4, the way that Paul speaks of him, it says that Abraham observed the law 430 years before it was written. And you go, how in the world do you do something like that? And the answer is that the only way that you can do it is to follow God that closely, right? The law is a teacher. It's mm-hmm. it's a pedagogue, as some would say, but it's a lot more than that. It reveals the character of God. And in showing us in contrast to the character of God, we see us for who we are. This is the way that John Calvin begins the Institutes of the Christian Religion, right? Mm-hmm. Is that if we want to see us for who we truly are, we first need to know God for who he truly is, and then we see who we are. Actually, by knowing who God is, we see who we aren't. And so I think when you look at Isaac, or Abraham and Isaac, the story of Abraham and Isaac, and you say, what is the blessing of God? Is that I'm going to provide for you, right? I'm going to provide. Josephus and other historians have looked at the time of sacrifice, and you'd have this pilgrimage that would come in to the place of the temple, and you would have animals being sacrificed. And the way that that they describe it, the early historians would describe it as, the blood would flow through the cities to the extent that it might flow over your ankles. I mean, there was that kind of sacrifice that was happening, right? And then you look at this story of Abraham and Isaac as a foreshadowing of what God was going to do through mm-hmm. Jesus. And absolutely, I think that you get... There's something that had to be this aha for Abraham and Isaac that they only could have gotten through the experience of obedience.
Could have been. All right.
It's a good question.
That was a good question.
Good one. Whoever's out there that did that one, good for you.
Yeah.
We're going to let them speak next week.
We should. Maybe an extra cup of coffee.
Yeah absolutely.
Let's see here. Let's go back to this one. This one has a lot of votes. Didn't Abraham have to trust God to find the place where he was supposed to sacrifice Isaac, and that very place is where Christ was crucified?
Yeah, it's been mentioned. I mean, if you think about right now, what's on the site of the place of the sacrifice of Isaac?
Well, we can't say.
Huh?
It's for the Muslims.
Yeah, it's the Dome of the Rock, right? So, I mean, so when you go in and you've got all of this history in one location, and you can mm-hmm. see why it would create a little bit of turmoil between people, right? Is because you have these sacred sites that one group is basically building their sacred sites on the top of. Right?
Well, it's the same story to a point.
And if you, yeah.
If you look at Muslim versus Christians, I mean, Abraham.
Well, but the difference.
I know there's a difference, but there's.
The difference in the Quran is who is who's asked to be sacrificed, right? So where in the Bible it's Isaac, and the Quran it's Ishmael. Mm-hmm. But Ishmael is the child of blessing for them, but that's of course the child from whom they're derived. And so, you know, so they connect their history a lot more intentionally to him. He's the child of blessing. He was the one that was asked to be sacrificed, not Isaac. And so there you go. A lot of history to that area, everybody. I mean, a lot. And so when you have some, you know, people thinking that, well, ultimately there's, I don't know, I'm just a little bit suspicious, you know, when you see peace agreements happening in the Middle East, and I'm looking at stories like this and the right. contrast there, I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I don't know. A lot of history, a lot of cultural disagreement, theological disagreement. Yeah. So. Yeah.
So, did we hear something? Okay, sorry, I thought someone asked a question.
That's okay. Yeah.
So Hebrews 11 brings up the faith.
Right.
And how does that, you know, why would that fit in with the rest of the people there who are mentioned there in Hebrews 11?
Well,
related to the
yeah,
the
if you look if you look at who's usually described as the Hall of Faith, I mean, mm-hmm. those people were pretty messed up too, y'all, right? Come on, let's be honest with ourselves. They were messed up, but they were still people that had, when you think about it, a deep faith, and there was something that God did that was extraordinary through them. I would hope that would be your story. I would hope that would be my story. I'm pretty messed up. All I ask is God do something incredible through me, right? But when you look at Hebrews and you get this definition of faith, the etymology of the word, or the root of the word, just means to have trust or confidence in. That is all that the word means. What it doesn't mean is to have trust or confidence in God without any evidence. It doesn't mean that at all. And what you see from Abraham is he had good reasons to have trust or confidence in God, right? That had led up to that moment when you think about it, because in every promise that God had made, he had delivered every single one. And that's why I think you could look in Genesis 22 and say, how confident could you be of God that if he said that Isaac is going to be the child of blessing, that God is going to deliver the child? And the answer is, well, what's going to stop God from delivering him?
Right.
I think that there's that. So, you know, faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. And you go, well, what are the things that are not seen? And part of that is what you're experiencing right now and what you have yet to experience. And when you think of what faith is, if it's to have trust or confidence in God, I think it's something like this. And I think that this is part and parcel of what's happening with Abraham. It's that my current situation and my future are going to be as the past has been. And here's what I mean by that, is that I have full trust and confidence that when God said he's going to do something, he will deliver. He'll deliver right now, and he'll deliver in the future. Mm-hmm. It's going to happen. It's going to happen.
Right.
So what's an example of that practically for me? That when I die, ultimately there's going to be a judgment, right? And I will be judged, but ultimately what's going to happen is there's going to be a resurrection of the dead, and that there's going to be a separation. I am fully confident. And this is something that you see even in Romans 8. Can death separate us from God? And the answer is not even that. Because right. death has been defeated. That's the beauty of the resurrection of Jesus. And then my promise is I participate in something. I have a new body. It has new properties. You know, here it's corruptible and perishable. Then it's incorruptible and imperishable. I get something that's new. What's going to stop God from doing it? And the answer is nothing. Nothing at all. The future is going to be as the past has been.
Right. You know, what's interesting with him is that he was the first one listed, and he had no point of reference compared
right.
to the rest of the people.
Not
he
yeah,
didn't have any scriptures
yeah. The
know.
Others had a little
yeah.
bit more of a body of work,
they
but
did.
Again, before Genesis 22, you have the call out of the Ur. You have the you have God directing his steps.
Right.
You have God being faithful in a lot of ways to him before that moment happened.
Right.
And all I'm saying is, it's got to count for God at some point.
Well, it does.
It's got
Absolutely.
To, right?
So, but
yeah.
he should have more faith than the other guys, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So he's higher up than the other ones.
I'm just saying.
All right. Let's see here. Do we have time for one more?
Let's do one more.
Let's see.
You're scrolling for like the juiciest one, aren't you?
I'm trying to find that, yeah. Well, it's one of those things where I don't want to repeat. I don't want you to have to repeat.
No, it's fine. Yeah.
Well, I think you've made it clear that God does reject child sacrifice for all.
Yes.
For all people. There's no, even if you go as far as Solomon forward, where he was worshiping Moloch and Gamash,
right,
and those, that's...
Yeah, but even there, he's held up as a negative example. And that's why,
exactly,
I said, you know, in 1 Kings 3, it says, be careful of women, warning to Solomon. I think God knew something about Solomon, right? Be careful of the ladies. Yeah. And by 1 Kings chapter 11, it says, and many women turned the heart of Solomon.
Right.
And what do you have Solomon doing?
Yeah.
You have Solomon committing the same atrocities that you had the people of God being judged for in other places.
Mm-hmm.
So how well do you think that's going to go for Solomon? Not well.
Right.
He's held up as a negative example.
So. He is, but he also gets multiple opportunities to turn.
He does.
It says there in the scripture that he goes there at least twice to tell him just this one point.
Absolutely.
And then the anger came. It wasn't like God, this goes to God's not angry and needed to just kind of not, well, God's not mean and angry and looking for just to take people out.
Right.
He's looking to forgive and mercy and grace.
Absolutely.
And we'd like to always kind of think that he's the mean guy looking down on us trying to smite us at any point.
Yeah, that's right.
Kind of like when we were out in the rain earlier today, you know, we're walking out, starts raining.
Yeah,
God did it to
earlier
us.
Today. Right. Yeah, that's exactly
same
right.
Sort of thing.
You know, like right when I walk out of the church this morning, it just starts pouring and I'm like, oh yeah, now. Right? And I got hosed. It is what it is. That's fine.
Yeah.
We needed the rain, so I'm not going to complain. I'm thankful.
It was a good rain.
My yard's getting crunchy, so thankful for the rain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we're good.
Is that a good way to end?
I think we're a good way to end.
All right. So hopefully tonight helped a little bit. I'll admit it's a difficult passage. You know, it's an easier passage than what I'm dealing with next week, though. And so, if you go into Judges, I just encourage you to read the book of Judges. I think it might be the most violent and graphic book in all of the Bible. You have all kinds of things that are happening in Judges. I'm going to be looking at one story next week, and that is the rape of the concubine. And see what it is. One, especially when you look at the Bible, and like I said when we started the series on disturbing behind divine behavior, I told you this, as if all you're doing is devotional reading, you don't have these questions. You just don't. Because you tend to go over into Paul, and it's like, I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength, right? And then you go about your day, and you come upon a hardship, and you go, I can do all things. And you know, that's good. It's for those of you that are seriously reading the Bible, and you come on these passages, and you go, you know, I don't know what to do with that,
right?
I mean, it seems like some pretty horrible things are happening there. All we're trying to do is to make some sense out of what some genuinely difficult passages, of those genuinely difficult passages. As you read Judges, you have that story, which is, I've tried to admit, it's the one that when I read it, shocked my conscience. And so I invite you to go back to read the book of Judges, and when you get to the rape of the concubine, I think you reread it and you'll see why my conscience just was, it went to the level of shock that it went. Because we ask this question, why is that even in there? Why leave that? And when am I going to preach on that on a Sunday morning?
That'd be hard.
Right? Yeah.
Well, when you're gone, that's what I was going to preach on. So.
Oh, yeah, good. Yeah, I tell you.
So
yeah.
You're going to kind of help
as I
set
lead
it
the
up.
Study trip to Israel, Matthew's got it, y'all. Yeah, everyone turned to Judges. Right?
Great fun.
I mean, how often do you hear pastors preaching on that on Sunday morning? And here's part of the reason that it's tough is because you know, the crowd that you have on a Sunday morning can range from children to very old adults, from brand new believers to very mature in the faith. And so it's trying to find that setting whereby you teach the full counsel of God. Hey, listen, I did a series at a church on the Song of Solomon, and I had people say, you know, I'm taking issue with you teaching Song of Solomon on a Sunday morning. And I was like, well, it's in the Bible, so I thought I'd just do it, right? I mean, teach the full counsel of God. Well, not that counsel, right?
Yeah,
we tend to cherry pick this stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no, if it's in there, let's go. I mean, let's do this. And so I did that. But for this, that's one of those. I did a study on Judges not too long ago, but it was on the judges. And as we got to the last one, I was like, that's all I wanted to do. We stopped with a couple of parts on Samson. I was like, oh, we're good. We're moving on. Nevertheless, we're going to keep on reading Judges and go to the rape of the concubine. And we're going to ask this really important question. If all scripture is God-breathed and profitable for reproof, correction, and instruction in righteousness, that a man of God might be mature and thoroughly furnished for every good work, why is that in there? And how does that contribute to that cause? But I'm going to leave that one for next week. Does that sound good? Awesome. Well, it's been so good to see you. I hope that you have a blessed week, and thank you for coming, and we'll see you next week.
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information on Veritas, visit www.veritaswbc.com.